What's your favorite hymn? We're going to produce a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' favorite hymns. Just send the title of your favorite hymn by Monday, May 21st to lynn@issuesetc.org. lynn@issuesetc.org.
We thank you, O Lord, for President Donald Trump's courage in acknowledging to the world a truth established 3,000 years ago, that Jerusalem is and always shall be the eternal capital of the Jewish people.
Ordinary authoritarians are content to forbid people from speaking truths, but he said totalitarians insist on forcing people to speak untruths.
Whenever I'm looking at a school or researching, the very first place I go to is their chapel service. That just tells me more about what's going on in that school and how it's oriented than anything else.
Those thorns and thistles came in Genesis 3 with the fall. The reason Jesus is crowned with thorns is because he's crowned with our fall. He suffered from his first breath to his last breath.
Luther says at the resurrection, it'll be like falling asleep and having a short nap, and we shall rise unto the resurrection and feel wonderfully refreshed.
Well, he was a character. There's no doubt about that. He had a striking figure, I'm sure, on the streets of New York, dressed almost all in white. He is known as and being heralded in most of the obituaries as the father of the new journalism. I think most people probably knew him from his novels, from his books, be it fiction or nonfiction. The Right Stuff, does that ring a bell? Or The Bonfire of the Vanities? Or if you go a little bit farther back into his writing career, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test? Well, if you know any of those, then you probably know the writing of Tom Wolfe. But you probably, if you only know those or his books, don't know everything there is to know about this journalist who happened to also have, I believe, a degree from an Ivy League school and was, well, for the better part of his career, writing in a way that irritated a lot of people, not just New York types. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 17th of May. We're going to be talking about media coverage of the life and death of author and journalist Tom Wolfe. Terry Mattingly will be our guest. Molly Hemingway will join us after that. She's a Fox News contributor. She's written recently about the New York Times coverage of the FBI's surveillance of the Trump campaign. She's got an awful lot to say about it, and we'll see what she has to say a little bit later in Hour 2 of Issues, etc. We'll spend some time with our listeners via the email address and the comment line. That email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. That comment line number, 618-223-8382. You can also join us with questions or comments via our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the life and death of author and journalist Tom Wolfe, Terry Mattingly. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Is there a relationship between Tom Wolfe, the intellectual, the PhD, and Tom Wolfe, the journalist?
Well, there certainly is, but I think it took a while for that to emerge. But first of all, just stop for a second and think about what you just said. I mean, because of the very unusual nature, I mean, this is a guy from the American South. His undergraduate is at a campus. I was on this campus just 2 weeks ago speaking. He was a graduate of Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. And then he ends up at Yale, where he does a doctorate in American studies. Now, it helps to understand that American studies is a label that gets applied to people. It's an interdisciplinary degree. I once considered applying for the American Studies PhD program at Duke. And basically, this is someone who wants to study a lot of different subjects surrounding one topic in American life. So it's not just a degree in, like, say, what English literature or American literature says about something. And it's not just the same thing as saying, I'm going to do a degree in political science. It's someone who is going to combine studies of political science, history, literature, law, religion, and other subjects. And they call such a degree an American Studies degree. And he did a PhD in that. Now, he completes his PhD, which, by the way, he was already scrapping with people at that stage when he first turned in his dissertation topic. The committee rejected it, saying that they thought his interpretation was too harsh of basically the American establishment and kind of ruling class left, kind of a sign of things to come. But when he completes his PhD from Yale, for Pete's sake, instead of applying at a bunch of academic institutions, he sends out letters to 100 daily newspapers. Barely hears back from any of them, but ends up taking an entry-level reporting position at the Springfield Union in Massachusetts. I mean, so this is entry-level daily newspaper reporting about cops and traffic and weather and maybe schools or whatever. General assignment journalism, square one, with a PhD in American Studies from Yale. From there, he goes to the Washington Post, where he begins to make noise in the style section. And the key is that in 1962, he arrives in the midst of the newspaper wars of New York City and joins the staff of the Herald Tribune, which at that point was deciding that if they couldn't beat the New York Times financially, dang it, they would just outright them. They would just become the spectacular paper for those who loved bizarre, experimental feature writing. And in that context, Tom Wolfe explodes into New York City journalism, eventually making his all but permanent home at New York Magazine and writing for Esquire and everybody else. And then the books begin to come out collecting his journalism. And from that, he grows as an author until finally he decides he's ready to write a novel. And I believe the first novel is Bonfire of the Vanities, which, of course, becomes a classic, a bestseller. And it just basically dissected and flayed New York City elite culture the way much of his writing had. And that's where we have to introduce two words from Tom Wolfe, the intellectual, that it took a while for those two words to climb into his journalism and then eventually into his fiction. And those words are status theory. There's a lot of people who think America is a country that doesn't have a status system, say to the same degree as Britain. This was something that Tom Wolfe never bought. And when he hit New York, recognizing this, perhaps this in Boston, being the two American cities in which status is most displayed, both in culture, money, real estate, intellect, fashion, etc., Tom Wolfe decides that he will just stick his thumb directly into the eye of the wealthy New York establishment and goes to work. The symbol of all this, once he hits, after a couple of years in the city, is the famous, the white suits. And he was asked, I love these quotes, he was one asked, what's the white suit all about? And he called the white suit neo-pretentious. And on another occasion, they said, what's the white suit? And he said, it's a harmless form of aggression. In other words, it's his way of standing out in New York. It also was his symbol for what it meant to be a reporter. He said, you walk up in a white suit and people stare at you and they want to talk to you. They assume you're there for a reason. But some people said it was also a symbol of him being kind of detached from around him. He was there as an observer with his notebook and his pencil in a white suit. Like, I'm not going to get dirty. Don't touch me. but answer my questions, and I'm here to observe very carefully. Very interesting man. But I think the intellectual bridge between the young man and the legendary journalist novelist that he becomes are those words, status theory. It's also what got him into trouble the most.
Talk about the term that's often most connected to him, and that is new journalism.
Well, that's really interesting because there's so many different ways of defining that term. To me, I mean, basically, it's basic, in-depth, saturation journalism, factual journalism. But the material is handled stylistically in the way that a novelist would do it. You're trying to interview people so deeply that you can recreate dialogue in ways that they would recognize as accurate. And you're not just telling a story of information. You're telling a story with a plot, and it has scenes in it and drama. And he takes you to places with that notepad, that pencil and pen, and the white suit. And it's like he stands there and turns the camera in a 360-degree circle, and you see everything that's around him. And it's told to you in this bizarre, strange stream of consciousness, language, and punctuation that really makes it like he's telling you the story himself. And it's that style, that extremely bold, radical style that people called new journalism. Wolf, on the other hand, he thought to some degree that he was going back in time, that what he was doing was not new journalism. He said that what I'm doing is old journalism. I'm taking a stance of the observer, a social activist, and a viewer. Think of me as doing Dickensian journalism. I'm trying to be Dickens. Here's what he actually said once when asked for a reference book called World Authors. Wolf wrote to him that new journalism, quote, meant writing nonfiction from newspaper stories to books, using basic reporting to gather the material, but techniques ordinarily associated with fiction, such as scene-by-scene construction, to narrate it. And he added, in nonfiction, I'm combining two loves, reporting and the sociological concepts American studies had introduced me to, especially status theory. So that's his own words.
This is very interesting because it's not exactly advocacy journalism. It's journalism with a very, very pointed point of view, a very definite point of view, however.
Well, he would say that it was advocacy in that he is the person who's telling the story, and he is there in person, first person, not kind of neutral third-person associated press in a lot of cases. So I think what he would say is he was going back to a 19th century style of reporting color through his own voice and through his own lens. Now, the key is while some people involved in new journalism were constantly followed by accusations that when in doubt, they just made stuff up, or when in doubt, they took three or four people and combined them into one character. So you took a lot of true actions by a bunch of people, and just for the sake of storytelling, you turned them into one character. A lot of people called that new journalism. That's not what Wolf is talking about. Wolf is talking about two factual but first-person, colorfully voiced journalism from the mid-19th century using first-person voice but hard factual reporting. He was known for his just saturation, in-depth interviews with people in which he would just dig out the most incredibly complex details and then back that up with regular reporting in documents and just other ways of gathering facts.
I don't want to get distracted from Wolf, but memory serves, have we discussed before new journalism?
Well, you've heard me say that to some degree, yes, you have heard me play around with this term, that a lot of the advocacy journalism, I've called it the new old new journalism, you know, or that essentially that this they're going back to the 19th century. And this is essentially journalism with a very strong editorial point of view. The key, though, is whether or not the reporters are committed to being fact-driven and factually based in their work. That's the key.
All right, then, can you talk a little bit? This is an interesting story about him. He writes about, he kind of kicks off his critique, his one might even say his satire of the elite New York society by writing something that made everybody at the cocktail party mad about a fundraiser for the Black Panthers.
The Black Panthers. Yeah, so here he is at the luxurious apartment of Leonard Bernstein of the New York Philharmonic, and he's writing in a 13-room Park Avenue penthouse duplex. And the Bernsteins' friends are there, but they're raising money on behalf of the Black Panthers. And Wolf basically just walks in with status theory. Remember, he's trying to portray this fascinating clash between two different levels of culture and status. Yet at this point, the Black Panthers are being raised up to the super rich, and not just the super rich. It's not just money. It's credibility and class within New York society. The New York Philharmonic, right? People are walking around with the most fancy asparagus tips and meatballs and hors d'oeuvres and all this luxury stuff. And of course, here's the Black Panthers, and yet the people walking around are maids dressed in maid uniforms with aprons. And he just soaked all of the irony out of this situation and wrote it up in a piece that Time Magazine talked to one of the Black Panthers reacting to it and asked him about this story by Tom Wolfe. And he said, "Oh, you mean that dirty, blatant, lying, racist dog who wrote that fascist, disgusting thing in New York Magazine?" I think you could say that he disapproved of the story. What was interesting, though, was the degree to which the world of New York art and music and literature, that world trying to come to terms with having someone just taking a razor blade and just peeling them back layer by layer intellectually, but also reporting all of this in, you know, the top environments of journalism there in their city. He slowly but surely became someone that they had to admire his writing. I mean, when someone like William F. Buckley calls him the most skillful writer in America, I mean, and even Norman Mailer is cheering for his failures, or what he considers his failures, while admitting that you maybe still have to admit Tom Wolfe is the best writer we have. He's making people in the most elite, highest levels of New York culture very, very uncomfortable. And eventually, they begin to realize that there is a distinct point of view here. And when I wrote my piece for Get Religion, I had not bumped into this quote yet. This is a quote from an interview in Rolling Stone in 1980, and it was quoted in a piece at National Review. Wolf is talking about his kind of collision of writing as honestly as he could, with no sense of reverence about these elites that are used to having people treat them reverently. And finally, he said this: "These days, if you mock the prevailing fashion of the world of the arts or journalism, you're called, wait for it, you're called a conservative, which is just another term for a heretic. I would much rather be called a conservative in that case than its opposite, I assure you." So now, finally, he is he's reached the point where by criticizing elite liberal New York culture, people finally pin the label on him. And this is where I was kind of reintroduced to his work about the, I mean, when I grew up as a journalism major in the 70s, there were Tom Wolfe books stacked to the horizon in every J school in America in the early 70s. But when the novel called A Man in Full comes out, people begin to realize, wait a minute, the key to this whole novel is actually religion. And it's set in Atlanta. And the question is not just what is religion, but it's what happens when religion is removed from people's system of ethics and behavior. And as many, many people said, the book is haunted by religion. And at the end, he ends up, this creates a whole other controversy we don't have time to talk about. Instead of saying that these people were Christians, he says to some degree they were at least trying to follow Zeus. And by that he means they're at least trying to behave in a way that presumes there are moral standards, that you're supposed to treat the poor with respect and help them because that's just right. It's in the fabric of creation that that's right, that there are ways to behave that are right and there are ways to behave that are wrong. And Wolf begins to criticize the upper class for having forgotten this. And even in a novel that I read that was, it got very, people either loved it or hated it. He even, in a novel called I Am Charlotte Simmons, he basically takes on the decadence of modern universities. And he's talking about basketball and sexuality and hooking up and people getting girls drunk and bad things happening to innocent girls. And people are beginning to go, gosh, this reads like he's attacking the sexual revolution. And this is when it all hit me. What does it mean to live in a world where people are suddenly talking about Tom Wolfe and people like Bob Dylan because of not just his conversion to Christianity, but an infamous album by Bob Dylan called Infidels, in which basically he says the infidels in our culture today are the people who do believe. In an age of belief, infidels were people who don't believe. In an age when you're not supposed to believe, in an age when you're not supposed to think that some things are true, really, eternally true, transcendently true, true in the nature of things. Who's the infidel in that culture? The infidel is someone who believes old things, who believes ancient truths. And suddenly it becomes apparent that this was now Tom Wolfe. And if the ultimate cool journalist in the history of the world, the arbiter of what it meant to be cool, for journalism, for a lengthy period of time, if Tom Wolfe was some kind of moral conservative, what does that mean? To some degree, people then began to just simply write him off because it was too painful to think of.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the obituaries that have been written about Tom Wolfe, and does he eventually belong in the same pantheon along with Norman Mailer or Gore Vidal, or maybe even Ernest Hemingway? Stay tuned.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Scientism is not science. It's a dangerous and self-refuting philosophy that fixates on means but ignores wisdom.
Dr. Angus Manouge of the Evangelical Philosophical Society talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And it leads to the abolition of man, as man is reduced to a material object. It's used as a weapon by atheists and skeptics to attack religion as a source of knowledge. It begins with Bacon's dictum, knowledge is power, but it overlooks the way in which power corrupts.
You can meet and hear Dr. Angus Manouge making the case against scientism at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. You'll find a list of speakers, topics, and registration information at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Terry Mattingly, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, about the journalism coverage of the life and death of author and journalist Tom Wolfe. What did you make of the obituaries you've read so far of Wolfe?
Well, they were very interesting. The New York Times, and of course, everything with Wolfe is about New York eventually. The New York Times obit was truly incredible. It was a very great job of writing. It touched most of the bases, yet I thought it was very interesting that it didn't do much with the end of his life and some of the controversies toward the end, which leads us then to New York Magazine, a journalistic address that's highly symbolic, you know, in the life of Wolfe, and one that you really can't stress too much how important his writing. Your question to where he ranks in the world of great writers and literature, I have no ability whatsoever to judge him as a novelist. I know people thought very highly of A Man in Full, and Bonfire of the Vanities is one of those things that was considered such a classic that it's almost hard to back off and view it as a book.
Well, I guess what I'm asking there is, in guys like Norman Mailer or Ernest Hemingway, and maybe to a lesser degree, Gore Vidal, we have author journalists, especially Mailer and Hemingway. We have, and I guess maybe the question is only about Hemingway, because he was a journalist who also wrote compelling stories that you sometimes wonder were even fiction.
Well, all of them have journalism in their blood. And to some degree, Wolfe argued that nonfiction had become the best American writing in the 20th century. And I would come close to arguing that. I would say we live in an absolute glory day of incredible nonfiction. I could turn away from the microphone here and just read you lists of books that are sitting on the shelves here in my office in Oak Ridge. And I mean, from The Devil in the White City to The Perfect Storm to all of Close to Shore, this incredible book about the shark that inspired the writing of the novel Jaws. We have all this amazing nonfiction writing that people are doing today. And a lot of it grew out of the revolution that Tom Wolfe and Truman Capote, of course, the writer of the first person to call his book In Cold Blood, to call it a nonfiction novel. Now, that gets us into a whole other controversy about the writing of that book. But my point is, at some point, you just have to say, his nonfiction is what he will be remembered for. And even his fiction, he would have called it reported fiction. If he was going to write about Miami, he almost lived in Miami off and on for like 5 years researching the book, doing a lot of careful work. So he would have considered that even his fiction included massive amounts of sociology and reporting. So I think in terms of the journalism era in which he lived and thrived, he's got to be right near the very top, which is why it's so painful for some people to have to think, could this guy have actually have been some kind of cultural conservative? Now, I have no idea what his specific religious beliefs would have been or not have been, but we live in a time when just saying you believe in absolute transcendent truth, that alone is controversial enough to get you labeled. There was one particular point that I noted in my article, Forget Religion, that really shocked me. One of the profiles, there's several, at New York Magazine, the longest one that I saw the day I was writing, it ended, Wolf spent most of the remainder of his life as a novelist with only occasional bits of pure journalistic writing. His final book, Back to Blood, was published in 1912. Now, that's really interesting that that's in the New York Magazine, because he published a book in 2016 called The Kingdom of Speech. And did you notice what elite worldview he dissected in that book?
Oh, yeah. He was going after Darwinism.
And in fact, a lot of people rolled their eyes or raised their eyebrows high up when my friend Eric Metaxas, in an age long before Trump, thank goodness. But anyway, Eric Metaxas was doing one of his Socrates in the City programs in 2013, and it was with Dr. Stephen Meyer marking the publication of the book Darwin's Doubt, which was basically about the intellectual structures of randomness in Darwinian theory. And Eric gets up there and he's doing the introduction and he looks out, and a couple of rows back in the audience, white suit and all, is Tom Wolfe. Now, if you're a writer in New York City, does it get your attention when Tom Wolfe is sitting in the audience?
Yeah, you might just want to sit down at that point.
But at that point, it's almost like Dr. Meyer will come back another day. We would like to know, why is Tom Wolfe at a lecture dissecting Darwin? Like, pardon me, sir, but what are you doing here? Well, he's working on a book, which even though he told CBS he had at least five other books outlined after that, I think, unless something comes out posthumously, I think we're going to find out that his last book is that book, Dissecting Darwin. And I don't know what to say. New York Magazine is a quality publication. Tom Wolfe would be at the top of any list of people known as a superstar of New York Magazine. Don't you think they would have looked up what his last book actually was? Now, I've heard people say, gosh, Terry, that's just got to be a plain old ordinary mistake. Well, maybe it is. But if that is a plain ordinary mistake, it's a big one, and it's certainly symbolic that by the end of his life, could they even deal with the fact that here was someone who not only had his doubts about Darwin's theory or elements of Darwin's theory, he would have said there are multiple ways of approaching Darwin's theory, and he was rejecting a particular way into it. He was basically saying that human language is the key evidence of man being the pinnacle of creation. But my colleague at the King's College, Paul Glatter, wrote a remembrance that was published at Forbes, and I thought, frankly, he did a way better job of summarizing the end of Wolfe's career. So let's look at this. He wrote in his piece, especially in his latter years, Wolf drew deeper from his PhD in American Studies at Yale University, thinking about American society and American thought. He became a critic of modern and postmodernism ways, a defender of traditional manners, and a proponent of a moral universe. Now, that's a great way of stating it. Proponent of a moral universe. Through novels and essays and public comments, he took aim at targets as varied as binge drinking and casual sex culture on college campuses, attacked the popularity of Bauhaus architecture, and challenged both the orthodoxy of Charles Darwin's evolutionary theories and the heterodoxy of Noam Chomsky's theories on language. That's a great summary of what truly made this man a heretic to the values of the New York, in which he was a towering figure. I don't think there's any way around that, especially if you look at him with his role as a journalist and public intellectual. He's a New Yorker's New Yorker, yet how in the world could he go there on some of these topics? It's a fascinating life story, and frankly, I hope people aren't through writing about it yet. I hope there are great interviews with him that have not been made public yet. Who knows? There might even be another book. This is a guy that made himself write 10 pages a day, even if he wasn't working on anything in particular. He wrote 10 pages a day. We can only hope there's one more book to come.
I wanted to ask about that at the very end here, if you would, with a minute or so. A disciplined writer who would get dressed and sit down and require those 10 triple-spaced pages. And like you say, if he was done in 2 hours, he was done for the day. And if it took him till midnight, too bad. But as a lover of the language, as a lover of the written word, I share that love very much so. What are your final thoughts on Tom Wolfe as someone who could use the English language the way he and few others can?
Well, I mean, he certainly was a unique stylist. I mean, the fact that people in writing tributes to him wanted to play around with just machine gun bursts of images and bizarre punctuation captures the modernity of his work, the modernness of his styling. But I want to go back to the fact that what he thought he was doing was combining social science and journalistic observation. So if we're going to say, will he last? I don't know if I can pass that judgment, but let's put it this way. When you get compared to Charles Dickens, and some people want to call you the American Dickens of the 60s and 70s, I think that kind of settles whether he has a historic role in journalism right there.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, it's always a pleasure. I'll talk with you again next week.
Glad to be here.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Molly Hemingway. She has written recently about the New York Times coverage of the FBI surveillance of the Trump campaign. She's got a lot to say about it. She thinks, well, maybe they need to go back and work on the facts a little bit and tell the story as it is. We'll get the full story from her right after the break. You could win an audio DVD of every presentation from all six Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. Record your answer to the question, Issues Etc. What does this mean? On our comment line, 618-223-8382. If we play your answer during Issues Etc., we'll send you a conference audio DVD of almost 50 hours of teaching. 618-223-8382 and answer the question, Issues Etc., what does this mean? Please be sure to mention where you listen.
Children are a human right. Children are a lifestyle choice. Children are angels. Children are a nuisance. There are not enough children to sustain the economy. There are too many children to sustain the planet. Need some clarity amidst all the shouting? Check out the May issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine. Hear from moms and dads, pastors and teachers about what it really means to receive and value the gift of children in our lives. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Holy Cross Evangelical Lutheran Church, Albany, Oregon, is a mid-Willamette Valley LCMS congregation where the liturgy lives and God's people worship as one, with sound biblical doctrine, weekly communion, and a clear confession of Christ crucified for the sin of the world. Please join us at 2515 Queen Avenue Southeast or visit our website at www.holycrosslutheranalbany.org.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Zion Lutheran, Muscoota, Illinois. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grace Lutheran, Auburn, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word, Rochester Hills, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Laramie, Wyoming. Redeemer Lutheran, Seymour, Indiana. Zion Lutheran, East Moline, Illinois. And Peace Lutheran, South St. Louis County. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.